Day by day, and with each passing moment, strength I find to meet my trials here. Trusting in my Father's wise bestowment, I've no cause for worry or for fear. He whose heart is kind beyond all measure gives unto his share what he thinks best. Lovingly is part of pain and pleasure, mingling toil with peace and rest. Every day the Lord himself is near me, with a special mercy for each hour. All my cares he fain would bear and cheer me, he whose name is Counselor and Power. The protection of his child and treasure is a charge that on himself he laid. As thy day, thy strength shall be in measure, this a pledge to me he made. Help me then in every tribulation, so to trust thy promises, O Lord, that I lose not faith, sweet consolation offered me within thy holy word. Help me, Lord, when toil and trouble meet thee, her to take as from my Father's hand. One by one, the days, the moments fleeting, till I reach the promised land.
All right. Let's turn our Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes, this one of the wisdom books after the book of Proverbs and before the Song of Solomon, which all of those are right before the book of Isaiah. And I'd like to just, this is more of a teaching kind of setting here this evening. I'd like to just bring to your attention a few things about the book of Ecclesiastes, and it'll become evident why I have two Bibles up here in just a moment. I often do this when I'm studying. I have two or more this Bible software called BibleWorks that I can have multiple versions open at once on my computer screen, so I can look at them all and compare them. And I've added some translations from the faculty at the seminary who've, when they go through books in our exegesis classes, like this, the class I took on Ecclesiastes, we had to translate the whole book from Hebrew and understand what it's talking about and, of course, write a paper and take some tests like you always do in these classes. So, but the instructors often have their own translations, so we have those as well. I wanted to just introduce the book of Ecclesiastes, not that I'm going to bring a series on this book at this point, but I thought it would be helpful for us, and not really only because Brother Duane is preaching a few times from Ecclesiastes. He's done that, and it's been very helpful to think about the subject of time as he's brought it to our attention. But just a couple of preliminary things. The book of Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon, despite liberal higher criticism to try to deny that. It was written by Solomon. It's claimed that way in verse 1 of chapter 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, there's not very many people who would fit that qualification as the son of David who is king in Jerusalem. And Solomon had the opportunity to embark on such an excursion as he did to search out meaning and purpose in life. And so, written by Solomon, the date would have been around the 10th century BC, because that's when he lived. And one of the if not the most important idea in the book that we will be looking at this evening to try to understand what the message of the book is this idea of vanity. I don't know if your translation has anything different, but the two that I have in front of me have vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I remember that verse because we had to look at it so many times in Hebrew. It goes like this. It goes, Havel Havelim Amar Kohelet. Havel Havelim Hakol Havel. And when you get into the study of the book and you really dig in to what he's saying, you can just hear several aspects of his personality coming through in that very verse, especially in the Hebrew. It just, with the way that it sounds, you can hear, first of all, the emotion that comes through. Vanity of vanities, he says. Everything is vanity. And then he goes on in chapter 12, if you flip back there in chapter 12 and verse 8, to say the same thing. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. And so the question will be for us this evening, what does he mean when he says that? That's a very comprehensive statement. Everything is vanity. He says it at the beginning of the book, and he says it many times throughout the book. I can't remember how many times, but just, you know, bunches and bunches of times. And he says it at the end. So it's like it forms the bookends on the book. There's a few comments at the end of chapter 12 to summarize what he's talking about and what his message is. But basically, it's at the beginning and at the end. Everything is vanity. And he says, I've explored all of it, and I found it all to fit under that category of vanity, of emptiness, of breath, wind. We'll figure out what that means in just a moment. But it's the key idea of the book, vanity of vanities, he says, all is vanity. Now, Solomon, as I said, had opportunity because of his vast wealth and his vast wisdom, God-given wealth and God-given wisdom, to embark on this journey of, as he says in chapter 1 and verse 16, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness, and I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is a grasping for the wind. It's a vexation of spirit, I think, is what the King James has. This is the New King James that I was reading from just now. And he embarks on this journey. When was this journey? Well, he took probably years to do this, as we would find out if we read the book. He tested himself, he says, his heart, to know about different things with regard to buildings and pleasures and people and animals and all sorts of things that he could ever think of. He tried everything to see about what is the meaning and purpose in life. And so I think the book, as I understand it, was written at the end of Solomon's life. The pursuit of it occurred during his life. And remember that he was turned away from God by all of the foreign wives that he took. But as I understand it, he came back at the end and he wrote this, as it were, swan song, to say what he found out. And what he found out is given to us at the end of chapter 12. He says, the conclusion of the whole matter is to fear God and to keep his commandments, for this is man's all. This is everything for him. For God will bring every work into judgment. It says there in verse 14, every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, so that's just the very briefest of highest level introductions. But now there's really two main interpretations of the book of Ecclesiastes. And English was asking me before the service, actually this morning, what am I assuming that everybody believes about Ecclesiastes when I say, you know, I'd like to share some things with you that might revolutionize your understanding of Ecclesiastes. And a lot of people do, it's true, understand the book to be a mainly a negative outlook on life, a negative book. In fact, this view has been popularized by the Scofield Reference Bible, and that's why I have this here. This is a new Scofield, New King James, which has the Scofield notes as they were revised in 67. The history was C.I. Scofield came out with this originally in 1909, then a revision in 1917, which we commonly call the Old Scofield Bible. And that popularized really dispensationalism among fundamental circles, helped to do that, and was very influential. In 67, another team of scholars, including McLean and Mason and others, worked on a revision, and they came up with this new Scofield Reference Bible, and that was 1967. Since, it's been transferred into the New King James in 84, or 89 maybe it was, and then in 02 it was combined with some other notes that Oxford did. This was in the original edition, the 1909 and 1917 was the first book, I think, that Oxford publishers did that sold a million copies. And Scofield was highly acclaimed as a scholar in both America and in Europe. But in any case, that he took a certain view of the book of Ecclesiastes. And so because of the popularity of the notes in his Bible, we have been influenced by this view of Ecclesiastes. He says here, or the revision says here, Ecclesiastes is the book of man under the sun, reasoning about life. The philosophy it sets forth, which makes no claim to revelation, but which inspiration records for our instruction, represents the worldview of one of the wisest of men, who knew that there is a holy God and that he will bring everything into judgment. So right away there, he's espousing a kind of negative view on the book, saying all this is man reasoning about life under the sun, apart from God. And, all he really knows is that God exists and God is going to judge things in the end. So they equate the idea of under the sun with really apart from God. Under the sun, under heaven, means that man, that here Solomon just looking at things with his wise mind, but it's still just a rational look at life. And in fact, the book really isn't even revelation. I mean, he says that right there. It makes no claim to revelation, but which is recorded by inspiration accurately for us, is what it says. And so a lot of people have just assumed this is the way that Ecclesiastes is. It's sort of a negative book that almost takes it off the plate, if you will, or off of the whatever, off of our radar screen as Bible readers, because we get to it and we think, well, it's hard to understand for one, and two, you know, the study notes are telling me that it's not revelation. It's probably not as helpful as the rest of the Bible. I'm trying to help you understand that our view of inspiration, of revelation, is that all of the Bible is equally inspired and it's profitable for us. So we can't, I want to be very cautious, and this is why I never seem to really get really into this interpretation of it, that it's scary to me to start to go down that path to say, well, one book is less than the others. I don't want to do that. I want to be very careful about saying that. And I think we can provide a good case for not a negative but a positive view of the book of Ecclesiastes. And that positive view is that Solomon was indeed searching for meaning and purpose in life. But he found out when he embarked on this search, he didn't know what he was necessarily going to come up with. But when he got to the end, he realized that life, because life is lived in a sin-cursed world, life is a puzzle. It's sometimes frustrating. It's an enigma. It's something that we can't grasp. And I hope to be able to prove that to you this evening as we look into this a little bit more. We cannot understand everything. For example, chapter 7 and verse number 15. Solomon, very observant, and here he's recording his observations, and he says, I have seen everything in my days of vanity. You know, it's the 10th century BC version of been there, done that. I've seen it all. He says, there is a man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness. The enigma of the length of life. Why is it that wicked people sometimes live a long time and righteous people are cut off? Or the enigma of justice, the lack of justice, chapter 8 and verse 14, says, there is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the works of the wicked. I mean, here's the Apostle Paul, you know, a just man, but yet he's beaten and he's all these things, imprisoned for his faith. But again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. And you can see that as he approaches life, as he sees it in the sin-cursed world, you know, he says, man was created upright, but their heart has devised many schemes. There's no man that's righteous before God, he says in chapter 7. There's not a just man on the earth who does good and does not sin. And he looks at this and he says, God, why is it? I can't understand it. You know, Havel Havelim, I don't get it. You know, it's a frustrating puzzle. I just can't get it. But he does have another side to the story. There's this tension in life. I don't understand it, but God has made it so that we can, if we fear God, we can enjoy life. We can live life. We can have a successful life in that sense of being God-fearers. There's a number of verses that talk about that. Let me see if I can find in chapter 2. Verse 24. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Verse 26. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. So, we're still right at the very beginning of the introduction here, that there are two views on Ecclesiastes. One is the negative view, that it's not really revelation. It doesn't really tell us much about God or how we're to live. I don't take that view. Let's be very clear about that. I understand that the book is more of, you can look at it more of a positive light. The light that there is a frustration to life, that we can't understand everything. Of course, our ways are not God's ways. Our thoughts are not His thoughts. He's designed things in such a way that, as our brother Duane has told us, that he has made everything beautiful in its time. But that doesn't mean that everything is beautiful. That means everything that's arranged together the way it is, if you look at the whole of the tapestry, is beautiful. But some of the parts of that tapestry are very difficult to understand and put together. But we can enjoy life, and he talks about that. You know, this book is not just about, you know, pure hedonism, you know what I mean? Just pure seeking after pleasure. He tells us that it's okay to enjoy the things that God has given to us, but just remember, God will judge you for how you have behaved and how you have done with those things that He has given to you. So it's not the eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die kind of hedonism. It's to enjoy the gifts that God has given to you because He wants you to, because He's given them to you. But remember that there will be judgment to come. And so you're accountable for those things that you do. Now, let me try to give you four or five justifications for why I think the book should be taken in this positive light. First of all, the phrase under the sun, occurs in the book 27 times. 27 times. under heaven occurs three times. For instance, in chapter 1 and verse 13, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. 14, I've seen all the works that are done under the sun. And so under the sun and under heaven are synonymous. They just mean the same thing. What do they mean? They mean on the earth is another way of saying it. He's not saying that under the sun means apart from God. He's saying under the sun means on the earth. Under the sun is the place, it's the location where Solomon's great search for meaning in life occurred. That's where he did his search, under the sun. He couldn't go over the sun. He couldn't go outside of the earth. He's bound to be on this earth. And he says, I saw everything under heaven. And I made conclusions from that. So, first justification is that under the sun does not mean apart from God. Under the sun means simply on the earth. It's the location of Kohelet's search. I should have said Kohelet. That's the word in Hebrew for the preacher. We call him in English the preacher or the teacher. In other literature, they often just use Kohelet as if it's a proper name for this person, but it's Solomon, of course. Secondly, my second justification, vanity, when vanity is used here, cannot simply mean useless or empty. It does not mean useless or empty. Why is that? Well, if you were to think about it, he's saying everything is useless, everything is empty. But then why do we live? I mean, why don't we just exit, check out now and forget about it? Well, it's because vanity doesn't mean that. It's not that all of life is useless. In fact, he commends to us the judicious use of God's gifts. He says in chapter 3, verse 12, I know that nothing is better for them, for mankind, than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. This is not useless. Verse 22, I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? It doesn't matter what's going to happen after you. God says, enjoy the works that you've been able to accomplish because of God's grace, because of what God has done. Chapter 5 and verse 18. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor which he toils under the sun, the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage. And for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. So vanity doesn't just mean emptiness. What the preacher is doing here is making conclusions. Given what I have seen, it's good for people to enjoy what God has given to them because, you know, God has given us to enjoy that, but he's also given us the adverse times as well. And so it's okay to enjoy the gifts. They come with the adversities as well. Thirdly, so this is first that under the sun means on the earth. It's not apart from God. Secondly, that vanity does not mean useless or empty. Thirdly, that vanity is parallel with another phrase in verse 14. Let's look at that phrase. It is in, if you have the old King James, says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. So he says, everything is vain, everything is vanity, and vexation of spirit. Another translation that you might have is a chasing or grasping after the wind. What does it mean to chase or grasp after the wind? What I'm doing now is trying to help us to understand the meaning of vanity by looking at the parallel phrase here, the phrase that's closely related to it, chasing after wind, vexation of spirit. Remember, wind and spirit are the same word in the original. It can be translated either way. Have you ever been able to grasp the wind? You try. You could try, you know. I didn't get it. I didn't get it. You know, I keep trying, but I can't get it. I can't stop the wind. I can't grasp. I can't get a hold of it. And so if you are about trying to do that, maybe you're a little child trying to catch the air, you're just going to be frustrated because you're going to try and you're going to look and you're going to say, I don't have anything. I didn't get it. And so what he's saying is life with all of the sin and all of the problems and all of this is vanity and a grasping for the wind. What I think he's trying to say is life is like that wind that's going by, and I'm trying to understand that wind. I'm trying to grasp it. I'm trying to get an understanding of it. And what I found when I did try was that I had nothing. I tried. And the ideas of vexation of spirit is good because it gives you an emotional connotation. He says, I'm trying to understand, but I just can't get it. Well, because he realizes eventually that it's outside of his grasp. He's trying to grasp the wind, but it's something you can't get. And so the idea of vanity is related to this idea of grasping or chasing after the wind. You just can't get to it. Vanity is also parallel with another phrase in 2:21. It says, for there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. In other words, you know, the guy builds up the family business, and then he dies, and who does he leave it to? You know, his son, who might be an idiot or he might not be, you know, but he doesn't know how it's going to turn out. This is vanity and a great evil. So Solomon is not, and Solomon's not just looking at this from an emotional perspective. It's not just like, oh, I'm totally frustrated. I give up. He's really thought about what he's doing. He said, I set my heart to understand and to know wisdom and folly and madness and all of these things. I've tried to really work at this. This has been his PhD project, you know, what's the meaning of life? And he's worked at it. He's thought about it. And so the idea of vanity has an emotional connotation to it, this frustration, and also a cognitive connotation. It's a thinking kind of thing. What he's saying is that life is a puzzle. It's a thinking problem, but it's frustrating at the same time. It's difficult to understand. And so you could say that vanity is not just emptiness, but it's like wind. It's breath is what it is. It's wind of winds. You know, everything is a passing thing that I can't get a hold of. So it's a frustration. It's a puzzle. And so really you could say a puzzling enigma, says the preacher. A puzzling, a frustrating puzzle. Everything is a puzzle. And so he's trying to sort out what is the meaning of all of this through his search. But life does have a value to it, and the preacher here tells us that. He tells us that, for example, well, we looked at it in chapter 12, that the sum of the matter is to fear God. And so now I'm going to move to my fourth justification for a positive interpretation of the book. The first one was that under the sun does not mean apart from God. The second one, that vanity does not mean useless or empty, but rather, thirdly, vanity is parallel with the idea of grasping for the wind and a great evil. It's a frustrating puzzle as to what life means and why it works the way it does and why sin how sin is involved. But thirdly, the preacher here does not write his book apart from the notion of God or of godliness or of the fear of God. In fact, four times He commends to us the fear of God. It's not just at the very end when he gets to chapter 12 that he realizes, oh, I blew it and I got to fear God. He's commending the fear of God throughout the book, chapter 5, chapter 7, chapter 8, and chapter 12. But he also tells us that God is involved in his search in many other ways. Again, under the sun does not mean apart from God, and Solomon is saying throughout the book, God is involved in his search. He says that God has ordered things the way they are. It says in verse 13 of chapter 1, again, where we looked, talking about a burdensome task that God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. Or back in Ecclesiastes 3, where our brother was preaching, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. So God has ordered the way things are. And Solomon admits that. He is writing the book with that understanding. He hasn't forgotten about God at all. He's consciously going about his search, trying to understand how is it that we can live in light of our situation and given these other things that God has done. God is also given the ability to enjoy things. We've read several verses about that. God gives wisdom and knowledge. Chapter 5, verse 19 talks about the fact that God gives riches and wealth. Any of you have riches and wealth? Well, many of you do. God has given it to you. God has given that and given you the power to eat of it, to enjoy it, and to receive your heritage and rejoice in your labor. God is sovereign. God has arranged all things according to the way He wants. It says in chapter 3 again, verse 14, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing can be taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him. So you see that Solomon has not, you know, written a book apart from God and then all of a sudden at the end popped God's name in there just to make it a book in the Bible. He's really written the whole book in a positive light to commend to us how we should live in this frustrating kind of world. Sometimes God prevents people from enjoying their wealth. He cuts off their life before they can enjoy some of the things that are available. It also says in the book that God will judge everyone. It says that in chapter 3, chapter 11, chapter 12. It says that God ordains prosperity and adversity, chapter 7 and verse 14. It says, in the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider, surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man cannot find out, or can find out nothing that will come after him. See, this is another key idea in the book, actually. We cannot see the future. We just can't see the future. We don't know what's going to happen after us. We don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow, for that matter. So don't ask God to reveal to you the future, okay? He's not going to do it. He's set up things so that we don't know, and that's just the way it is. We're not going to know the future. We're not going to know how things turn out. We have to make wise and judicious decisions given what information we have now. That's what God wants us to do. Not worry about tomorrow. That's what Jesus said, right? Concern yourself about today, not tomorrow. Live today in the way that God wants you to, and then live tomorrow that way as well. God made man upright initially. It says in chapter 7 there, verse 29, truly this only I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. And then finally, it says about God in chapter 11, verse number 5. As you do not know what is the way of the wind, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything. Ultimately, God's ways are not fully comprehensible. We say God is incomprehensible. That doesn't mean we cannot know Him at all. It just means that we cannot know Him fully. His ways are not fully comprehensible. And so, my fourth justification now, we're still talking about that, is that the preacher appeals to the knowledge of God, to God's revelation, to God's character, to God's ways and His works in the book. And so, we should not write off Ecclesiastes as if it has nothing to do with God or it's just man's reasoning. This is a man who is informed about God, and he tells us about Him. I looked up all these verses 35 times in the book. In these short 12 chapters, he mentions something that we should do toward God or that God has done toward us. In fact, just to carry on in that idea just for a moment, what we should do toward God. Well, we should fear Him. We should be careful as to how we approach God. You know, just don't barge right up to the temple and just, you know, go in carelessly, he says. Be careful how we worship. And he says in chapter 12 and verse 1, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. You know, before the difficult days come. And so the preacher is not written here a book of just human wisdom, of rational apologetics or something like that. He's just said, look, this is the way I've searched life out. It's tough to understand. But God has given us certain things. We know that God is active in certain ways, and we need to live in light of that. And then finally, fifthly, my fifth justification for a positive approach to the book, an approach that really gives a hearing to Ecclesiastes as it stands on its own merit in as the 60, part of the 66 books of the Bible. My fifth one here is that the preacher has a God-informed view of the world. If he did not understand the book of Genesis, Solomon, if Solomon did not understand Genesis, he would not have been able to write this book. He's not, again, just running off and doing his own thing. But he understands that God is the Creator. We just said that. Remember the Creator in the days of your youth. He remembers and he knows from Genesis that man is sinful. God made man upright, but there is no just man on the earth that does right and does not sin. He knows that God has given man work to do. When did God first give man work to do? We've talked about this in the garden. Before the fall, God has laid on man a task, tend the garden. Man didn't just have the lazy boy chair and the remote control and sitting in the Garden of Eden, you know. He had work to do. And this work continues, and it's just been made more difficult by sin and by the curse. But it is the case that Solomon understood man and sin and all of these things. He understood also, this is a very interesting one, he understood that man was created in God's image. If you look back in chapter 3 and verse 11, we mentioned this before on a Wednesday evening, and Brother Duane did, that he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into their hearts, man's heart, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. And so this would correlate with the creation of man. God, when he created mankind, put in man eternity in their heart, in our hearts. We all have a capacity for understanding time beyond ourselves. We can understand eternal things, things before us and things after us. In fact, that's the whole, I guess, really point of the book, in a sense, that or basis of it. Solomon comes to this task with an understanding. I know what comes before, and I know what's now, and I know what comes after, and now I'm trying to fit this whole thing together. And I say, I can't make sense of it. God has put a desire in man's heart to understand eternal things as part of his image in man, but yet man cannot find out the end of the matter. That's what it says here in verse 11. He cannot find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. So man has a capacity to understand certain things, but he does not have the infinite capacity that God has, the infinite wisdom that God has to understand the whole big picture. Only God does that. Only God can do that. And so we see that the preacher here is not reasoning apart from God at all. His mindset is just chock full of information about God, what God is and what he's done, and what man is and what man has done, and how these things relate. And you know, he's on the earth. That's the only place he can be. And he's undertaken the search. And he saved us, he saved a lot of people, I guess, if they would listen, a lot of time. There's a illustration I just received today from Dee Dee. She gave me a copy from the Washtenaw Legal News, I think. I can't remember the exact title of that newspaper. But there's an attorney who has gone around making this movie about the great oneness of us all. And he's gone to religious leaders in different parts of the world, and he's asked them questions about the meaning of life. And, you know, this is kind of the classic, what is the meaning of life pursuit. And he's found that everybody's one, and everybody just wants to be happy and this and that, and not a word about God or anything like that. If he would just read and understand Ecclesiastes, he'd find out that somebody with far more wisdom than he has and vast wealth beyond what anybody could imagine has undertaken that search already. And they have found that the sum of the matter is to fear God and to keep His commandments, to understand God and to be rightly related to Him. Apart from that, everything is empty. But in the meanwhile, Solomon says, I understand that you have trouble understanding the puzzle of life, because it is a puzzle. It's difficult. But that's the message of the book, that we can, properly related to God, we can enjoy the gifts that God gives us, but just recognize the good comes with the bad. Sometimes injustice prevails, but ultimately God will bring everything into judgment. And so we can live in that light. And somehow that to me seems to really kind of break the tension, if you will, between the bad and the good, between the puzzle and just trust to know that God has it all in control and that He's going to take care of it. So I wish we had time for questions. We don't have that kind of forum just now, but let me know if you do have some. Maybe that's different for you to hear that interpretation of the book. But there are a lot of things in there. Oh, it's just good. I mean, you know, here's one that I've used in marriage counseling. Solomon says, not only the Proverbs also says this, but Solomon says this, gentlemen, you are to enjoy the wife of your youth. You're told to do that. That is wisdom. And it's not hedonism. It's not hedonism at all. It's to maintain a proper marriage relationship with your wife, purity and enjoyment and all those things. It's okay to enjoy being married. You know, this is not hedonism. This is thank God for the gift that He has given to me in my life. And so that's a good word. We don't have to shy away from the book of Ecclesiastes. As someone said, you know, when you read those things in Ecclesiastes, you can't believe them any more than you can believe the lie of the devil in Genesis chapter 3. I take objection to that, exception to that. God has given us gifts in life. He's given us our spouses. He's given us wealth. He's given us abilities to do things. We must use them and enjoy them in a way where we show that we understand God will judge and that we are doing things according to His plan and His ways and not just running amok. But it's okay to have that other side, enjoyment of life as God has given it to us. And not just to write off the book of Ecclesiastes as if it were, you know, book number 66, you know, just kind of leave it in the dust. All the rest is what we need to learn. No, we need to learn all of it, and including Ecclesiastes. Solomon may have gone wrong in his life, but have you not gone wrong? You know, if we blame Solomon all the time, you know, look at him, what a rotten egg. Well, what about you and me? You know, we've botched up life too, I'm sure. Not in the ways that he had opportunities to do, but don't think if you had his position and power and money that you wouldn't do the same thing. So Solomon goofed it up, but Solomon was a believer after all, and God used him to write this book of Scripture. So we thank Him for that. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father,